You know that sound. Most of us take flushing a toilet for granted, but for lots of people, finding a place to go is a real problem. More than a third of the world's population doesn't have access to sanitation, and that leads to disease, diarrhea, and death. This hour, in honor of World Toilet Day, the cutting edge of toilet research, from low flow to no flow, a look in the latest in toilet tech. Plus, 2 years ago, Geron started clinical trials with embryonic stem cells, using them to try and treat spinal cord injuries. This week, the company said it was abandoning that work. What are the implications for all stem cell research? Some answers in your questions after the break, so stay with us. Habla Español? Check out our science news in Spanish over at sciencefriday.com/Spanish. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. Tomorrow is World Toilet Day, and if you have a toilet, that's a cause for celebration, because more than a third of the world's population does not. For 2.6 billion people, going to the bathroom is, well, there is no bathroom to go to. People don't have access to the sanitation and sewer systems that we take for granted here. Without a place to go, people defecate into ditches, waste get dumped into waterways, and diseases spread. The sponsors of World Toilet Day are trying to change that by bringing attention to the problem. And one sponsor, the Gates Foundation, is challenging engineers to build a better toilet, giving them money to do it. It's called the Reinvent the Toilet Challenge. Frank Reisberman is director of water sanitation and hygiene at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle. Dr. Reisberman is here with us. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you. Good morning, Ida.
Good afternoon to you. Rose George is author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. She joins us from the BBC in Leeds. Welcome to Science Friday.
Thank you.
Dr. Jim McHale is vice president of engineering at American Standard Brands in Piscataway, New Jersey. You know, they make all those bathroom fixtures, including that famous toilet that seems to swallow everything up on YouTube. Thank you for being with us today, Jim.
Thank you, Ira.
Let's talk a bit, Dr. Reisberman. Tell us about World Toilet Day and what the point of it is.
Well, World Toilet Day tries to bring across the same point you just made, that an astonishing third of the world population does not have access to flush toilets. Yes, flush toilets have saved more lives than any other invention, but at the same time, lack of them still causes an incredible number of death among young children from diarrhea.
With 2.5 billion people, that's a big number. How do you even get your arms around it? How do you tackle that problem?
With great difficulty. A lot of people are trying that, in fact, and we are doing things. It's not as if we have to reinvent the toilet before we can start working on that problem. But yes, we do think that particularly for people who live in slums in developing countries, in very high-density, low-income areas, we don't really have a toilet that works for poor people.
So you're looking for, actually, you said we don't have to reinvent the toilet, but you actually are asking people.
Yes, we are asking people to come up with a toilet that does not flush, you know, clean water down an expensive set of pipes to get into a wastewater treatment plant where we're spending even more energy and money to get that waste out again. We'd love for people to have what we sometimes call the cell phone of sanitation, an aspirational product that actually recovers resources from waste. There's a lot of energy in human waste. There is nutrients there, and we'd love to find a way to reuse those directly without relying on flushing your waste down the drain with clean drinking water.
So you're looking for some really creative engineering and giving money to engineers to design a better toilet.
Yes, indeed.
And how long is the contest going to go on for?
Well, within a year, we'd love for people to show that their crazy ideas have some value. And then next year, August, we hope to have a big fair where people demonstrate all those prototypes. And then we'll have more money to take the best ideas forward into toilets that people can actually use.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you apply for, if you're an engineer and you have a crazy idea, how do you get a grant from you folks?
Well, we had several open contests, and Daniel Ye, that you're going to talk to later, was one of the hundreds of people who send those ideas. And then we have those reviewed by external experts, and we funded a bunch of these, about 26 in April, and another 31 that were published just last week.
Let me bring on Dr. Ye. Dr. Daniel Ye is an engineer who was working on one of those toilets. Welcome to Science Friday.
Hello, Eric. Great to be here.
Thank you very much. Can you give us an idea what your idea is?
Okay. To start, I need to talk about how we currently treat waste. Typically, in municipal wastewater systems, you know, we use what's called activated sludge, which is a rather energy-intensive way to get rid of the organic material, namely in waste. And as Frankie said earlier, this is energy-intensive and also does not recover energy. Mm-hmm. So we like to do it differently. We like to do it using anaerobic organisms, which are naturally present. And through the anaerobic organisms, you can reroute the organic content or the electrons that are embedded in the organic material into methane. Mm-hmm. And then along with that waste, there's nitrogen and phosphorus, like Frank mentioned. So the trick now is to how do you get to the nitrogen and phosphorus in the water safely? And we will be doing this in conjunction with the membrane, an mm-hmm. ultrafiltration membrane.
Mm-hmm. So the idea is not to just dump the waste, it's to more or less recycle it back into something else.
It absolutely is, because if you look at waste, what's waste to us is actually food for microorganisms. And when you really come down to it, it's nothing more than carbon, nitrogen, and phosphorus. But it's just the fact that there's pathogens in there. There's also social stigma attached to it. So we need to find ways to overcome those.
And how much time do you think it will take you to come up with a working idea here?
We have already built that in the lab, and what we call that the new generator, which means nutrients, energy, and water, new generator. We have a working prototype in the lab, and what we're doing now through the Gates Foundation grant is to move that into the field for a field demonstration and to ruggedize the unit.
Is it something that anybody could build, even, you know, in a place that doesn't have a lot of resources?
I think you're going to need some resources to build it, but then the challenge is how we're going to make this fit into the existing sanitation cycle. And then, of course, affordability would be an issue. But, you know, I like to always look at the USB drive example. You know, when the USB drive first came out many years ago, it was very expensive.
Right.
And, you know, frankly, I don't know how that works. But now you can get one for, what, $5?
Right.
And so I think if there's a demand, we can create the right market structure. Anything can be affordable.
All right. Good luck to you, Dr. Ye.
Great. Thank you.
Thank you for taking time with us. Dr. Ye, Daniel Ye, is an associate professor of civil and environmental engineering at the University of South Florida in Tampa. We're talking World Toilet Day coming up tomorrow around the world, and we're talking about toilet technology. Let me bring on Rose George. She is author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. Why is it so unmentionable, Rose?
Well, I think actually one of the good things that since I wrote that book, which was in 2008, I think it's become much less unmentionable. And but there is a conversational and societal taboo about this. And the interesting thing about this taboo is that it's not actually that old. It only goes back 200 or 300 years, which was just about the same time that the flush toilet became the norm. And so you had this odor-free device that you could have inside your house, which was unthinkable beforehand. If you'd ever encountered a 17th century privy, you wouldn't want it anywhere near you. So you had this clean and nice, fresh-smelling device. And at the same time, I think because we could do that, because we could put it behind a closed door, we could also not really think about it and not discuss it. And that's had really quite damaging effects. Up to the point where, you know, it, as Frank said, in 2011, we're in this ridiculous situation of children dying of the runs, of diarrhea, and surely, you know, we can solve that.
Mm-hmm. Do you think that if some toilet designers of 100 years ago were alive today, they could walk up to the modern toilet and say, I can still fix that?
I think if you took a standard Western toilet, yes. I think if you took, there are these quite amazing Japanese high-tech toilets, and that's a whole different kettle of fish. But I think, yes, if you got hold of Joseph Brammer or Alexander Cummings and asked them to fix the toilet, I suspect they'd be able to. I don't think Alexander Graham Bell would be able to get to grips with an iPhone quite as easily.
Mm-hmm. Jim McHale, you work on some of the cutting-edge designs in toilet technology for American Standard. What are some of the challenges in toilet design today?
Well, first let me say we are also interested in the work to help developing countries get toilets, and I've been talking with Frank about what we can do to help. But here in the U.S. market, the challenges are more around water conservation. What can be done to change the designs to get toilets to function properly on less water? There's the EPA's Water Sense initiative that tries to promote the use of what we call HETs, toilets that function on 20% or less water than a typical 1.6-gallon toilet. So we spend a lot of time designing toilets that work on less water, but actually that really flush well and aren't going to cause somebody to have to flush the toilet twice, because that really is the nemesis of water conservation, is when somebody has to flush twice or three times to really clean the bowl.
So that's a real engineering challenge then.
Absolutely. We use the best available tools and find the best available people to solve that problem, just like any other industry would solve their problems.
1-800-989-8255 is our number, talking about engineering toilets on the World Toilet Day tomorrow. You can also tweet us at SciFry, at SCIFRI. Let's go take a call or two before the break. Let's go to Russell in Cincinnati. Hi, Russell.
Hey, how you doing?
Hey there.
Hey, I'm sitting here listening to this, and I'm thinking to myself, what's the big deal? The Clivus Multrum toilet has been around since the 60s. I know that much. And that's a composting toilet. It already exists. And when you drive through all the rest areas and more of the public restrooms that you're going to now, they've got toilets and urinals that don't use any water at all.
Yeah, good question.
It already exists, so why are we trying to find it?
Frank Reisberman?
Yes, and indeed that has been a common reaction. People have been proposing composting toilets to us, and indeed if you have a mountain cabin here in the U.S. or so, that may very well be a good solution. They've been around a long time. They've been tested in developing countries, and they work for some specific conditions. But for those that we're looking at, slums, lots of people sharing toilets, they fill up too quickly. They don't properly function. So we recognize that for some conditions, composting toilets work well. And actually, we have some grants that make those even better. But for the majority of the conditions we're looking at, it's not a good solution. We want something. In fact, the composting toilet is sort of an improved outhouse, if you like. We'd love to get to a toilet, an aspirational product, the cell phone of sanitation, that you and I would also want to have in our house, and that doesn't reduce the flush to, say, 1.4, 1.2 gallons per liter, but to zero.
All right, there it is, the iPhone of toilets. We're going to come back and talk more with Frank Reisberman, Rose George, author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, Jim McHale, Vice President of Engineering at American Standard Brands in Piscataway, New Jersey. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Maybe you have an idea for the toilet of tomorrow, the iPhone of toilets. We'll be right back after this break. Well, the holidays are right around the corner, and if you're already trying to get your holiday gift list together, may I request that you keep Science Friday in your thoughts. It may be hard to believe, but the bulk of our funding comes from private donations like yours. This is what goes to create the radio show, our podcasts, websites, social media, phone apps. So please, give what you can, $5, $10, whatever works for you. We'll send you a tax-deductible receipt, and you can even make donations as a gift to someone else. Just visit our website at sciencefriday.com and click on the link to support us. And thanks. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. We're talking this hour about the toilet of tomorrow. What would be the ultimate toilet? How should it be designed? With Frank Reisberman, Director of Water Sanitation and Hygiene at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation. Rose George, author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters. Jim McHale, Vice President of Engineering at American Standard Brands in Piscataway. Our number, 1-800-989-8255. Jim, you heard Frank say that the ultimate toilet would have no water in it. Is that something practical for an American consumer, though?
In the short term, probably in my lifetime, I would say no. There's very cultural aspects with a toilet as well. Frank mentioned how people don't like to use composting toilets, and a lot of it has to do with the smell. Water has the main function of water is that it reduces the smells during the during the process. So I really cannot see that happening in the near term.
Rose George?
I think, I mean, it's certainly true that there are cultural aspects to sanitation which make it extremely tricky to solve, sort of to find a perfect solution across the world, which is probably partly why we're in the situation. But I am more optimistic, I think, possibly than Jim. I mean, one of the lovely anecdotes I was told was from a Norwegian professor who told me that a friend of his, their children, their family had a composting latrine at home, thought that was completely normal. And the day that they went, started kindergarten, were absolutely appalled to find that they had to drop their waste into a load of water, and they just didn't like the plop and the splash. So I think things can change slowly. I certainly don't think that the composting toilet is a solution in many situations, but the point about sanitation and the trick to solving sanitation, which we're now all understanding, is that you have to be flexible. One solution is not going to fit someone else. As Frank said, you can't really be imposing sewers in a slum, for example, or composting toilets, because no authority is going to want to install infrastructure in a slum, because that would automatically imply that people have land rights. So there's all sorts of political issues. So sanitation is really complicated. That makes it fascinating, but it also makes it a huge challenge.
Mm-hmm. But composting toilets, they're used in public places. I know around here in New York, the Queen's Botanical Garden has a wonderful composting toilet. It looks great and has no smell. Took a tour of it once myself. There are other places that use it. Perhaps public places are where we might see them blossoming, for lack of a better word. They don't smell at all. You know, it's surprising.
They can work, and we are certainly not against composting toilets, and we'd love to see them improved further. Normal composting can take up to 6 months before all the pathogens are really removed from the waste. Particularly worm eggs persist very long, so we'd love to have something that is really safe much quicker than that, which probably involves higher temperatures. But we are certainly not against composting toilets. But as you say, they've been around for a long time, and they've had clearly, if you like, issues to be adopted at a wide scale. We'd love to see something that gives billions of people a new toilet much before Jim passes away. We have to be rather more impatient optimists than that. And we think we can see solutions that will be ready for millions of people more like in 3 to 5 years rather than 20 to 30.
If I heard what you just said, that if, you know, it's too long to wait for a few months for all these pathogens to settle out, are you saying that you might be able to create a toilet that sort of sterilizes itself?
Yes, we have a lot of other options that are currently being researched. I mean, like Daniel Yeh, we have about 60 of those grants this year, and some people propose to use a method that is similar to creating charcoal. It's called creating biochar. In essence, you heat it up to about 250 degrees, which after 10 minutes is pretty sure to no longer have pathogens. And it creates this biochar, which is like charcoal, which you can then either put in the soil as a soil improver, or in some cases where people cook on charcoal, it could even be a cooking fuel.
So you have to not only create a new kind of toilet, but you need a system for disposal of what's left.
That's critical, yes. And actually, we are saying where the current methods all look at this as waste that is costly to remove, we are looking at it as resource recovery, as recycling, and that can actually get some money back to people that makes this all affordable.
So like we used to throw out newspapers and bottles, which we don't do anymore, we recycle them, somebody might come by. Our toilet might be situated maybe with a door on the outside of our home or our building, and somebody could come by and just replace it or the removable parts.
Yes, actually, those kind of cartridge toilets are definitely being researched. We are working with a small NGO called Sanergy that in Kibera, one of the worst slums in Nairobi in Africa, brings people these little cartridge toilets that actually do fit in their homes and collects them every couple days and then brings them to a neighborhood recycling place where you'd have a machine that creates biochar, like charcoal, out of human waste. And that actually, for us, you'd be able to reduce the cost of treating waste to zero by basically generating revenue out of waste.
Jim McHale, you have this great video of an American Standard toilet, Standard Brands toilet on the internet that no matter what you throw down there, from dozen golf balls to 53 chicken nuggets, or 56 is it, everything flushes. And with one flush, what is the engineering miracle there? What did you accomplish? How did you figure out how to do that?
That's our H2 option siphonic dual flush toilet. The trick to getting toilets to flush that well is all optimization of the internal chambers that you can't see. The water is flowing through different passageways as it leaves the tank and eventually winds up in the bowl and down the trapway and down the drain. And as I think I mentioned earlier, we use computational fluid dynamics to understand the flow through those chambers and to reduce turbulence wherever it occurs so that we're not wasting any of the energy in the tank, any of the energy of the height of water in the tank, right? That's the only potential energy available to remove the waste. So the channels have to be designed perfectly to not waste any of that energy and make it do the work that we need it to do.
How about the composition of the toilet itself, the porcelain? Is there a special material, coating or something that's on that?
Well, the other aspect is there's removing the waste. There's also cleaning the walls of the bowl. And there we've engineered what we call Everclean antimicrobial glaze. The glaze is the glass coating on a piece of ceramic. It's what makes it look white and shiny. It's actually a glass coating. We've engineered that glass coating to be ultra smooth on the nano scale so that material doesn't stick to it. That also helps with the flush, because we don't need to use as much water to wash the walls of the bowl, and we can put more water into powering the flush and moving waste down the drain.
Because as we said before, that double flush is what wastes a lot of that water.
Yes, it does. And that's you know, sometimes toilet designers will miss that aspect of it. And you can have a bowl that removes waste, solid waste, very effectively, but if it doesn't clean the walls, people are going to flush it twice.
The toilet I hate to use the most is the one in airplanes that has that air sucking through the toilet bowl. I think that's really probably, this is my own point of view, it's so loud it really hurts your ears. I wonder if it breaks OSHA rules or something for sound level of some way. Has anybody thought of using that kind of technology, though I wouldn't want to use one myself?
Yes, actually. In places where, in China, where they don't want to use 6 liters or 1.4 gallon or so to flush their toilets. The next thing, if you use only the 1 liter or so that people use to clean themselves, that's not enough to transport the waste. So then you have to have vacuum tubes in apartment buildings, not necessarily the cheapest option, but that helps, like an airplane toilet, to move waste with very little water.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Debbie in Layton, Utah. Hi, Debbie.
Hi
there.
I just have a quick comment. My family and I lived in Shanghai, China, actually, until just a couple of years ago, and we always thought it was so interesting. You know, the vast majority of toilets, especially in public places, are, we call them squatters, for, you know, lack of a better term. And even when you could find a Western toilet, we would go in and we would very often see footprints where people had stood on top of the Western toilet because they thought that it was unhygienic to sit on a toilet where someone else had sat, and they didn't know how to use it. And I was just wondering if you could comment on the cultural implications of trying to switch, even in a country like China that obviously has the money and the political will to do it, still has not happened.
Rose,
thank you.
Thank you. Rose George, any comment?
I've heard of that as well. That's a pretty common tale of footprints on the seats. I mean, I'm not sure if Jim from American Standard is going to like this, but ergonomically and biologically, it's actually much better for us to squat anyway. So I'm not actually against those mysterious footprint levers on toilet seats. Obviously, hygienically, it may not be the best thing, but if they wiped afterwards, then I don't see that much wrong with it. So I don't see it as a huge cultural barrier. But it is interesting, if you look near to China, if you look at Japan, they went from, in about 60 years, from a nation of people who squatted and used pit latrines, essentially, to people sitting on Western seats and using Western-style toilets, although much improved and innovated upon, or certainly more advanced in terms of the robotic technology and stuff. So it can be done, but it was a massive cultural shift, and it was very difficult and took about 20 years or so. Hmm. We have all these quirks about our attitude to how we dispose of our own human deposits. I don't like to use the word waste. I avoid it if I can. But we're not rational beings about this, which is what makes it such a interesting topic and endlessly rich.
Because you know we do use manure from other animals as fertilizer and don't think twice about it, but people would be a little squeamish to use human.
Well, I when I was in a village in India in Orissa, I remember vividly meeting a young woman who I was talking to her about whether she wanted to use a biogas digester, which is an anaerobic digester, which they're very popular in China. About 18 million households have them, and they're very energy efficient. You just tap off the methane and you can produce, you can use it for cooking gas and use electricity. But in India, there is an attitude towards human waste, which is very different, and it's very much seen as a taboo. So she looked absolutely horrified and then immediately stuck her hand in a big bowl of green cow manure and started spreading it all over her wall. So, you know, we are strange creatures.
Here's a tweet came in from Science Friday and Second Life that says, why isn't water from showers and washing machines normally reused for flushing toilets? It's even illegal by city building codes. Why? We're not drinking it. Why should we not use it? Well, any thoughts on that?
That actually is being done in some areas. It's called gray water reuse. People are collecting the water from the sink where you wash your hands, or collecting water from a shower and reusing it to flush the toilets. Actually, I think the Gates Foundation headquarters has toilets and urinals that function like that. A lot of new buildings are putting in systems to handle gray water in that manner. It's an infrastructure challenge, though. You need to put in the system to do it, but it's certainly feasible.
I think it's a regulatory challenge as well. I think a lot of times it's not that it's illegal or legal, it's just that the regulations aren't there. So people, you do have a kind of underground grey water recycling community and that they're not quite sure where they stand. But it just makes perfect sense. There should be more of it.
Mm-hmm. I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Rose, you went to Japan to investigate the toilets there. We've seen pictures of these toilets that cost thousands and thousands of dollars. What's your feeling about this?
Well, I have to confess, I do actually have one. Mm-hmm. So I feel very happy about it. But it was given to me by Toto, who are the leading brand, and I should say, without wanting to give them market advantages, that the second brand is called Inax. Anyway, there are basically three big Japanese plumbing companies who have developed these astonishing toilets. And of course, you don't need a several thousand dollar toilet. I mean, they are amazing. But what they do, which is, I think, their biggest selling point, is that they can clean you. So if you actually think about toilet paper, toilet tissue, we're using something dry to clean the dirtiest part of our body, whereas we wash everything else. It really doesn't make much sense. Whereas these Japanese toilets, and you can just get a sort of add-on toilet seat, which has an inbuilt bidet nozzle. And I think hygienically, they are far superior to my toilet in the UK, for example.
But then you're using more water.
You are using a little more water. I haven't looked into the exact statistics of it, but it's not that much. Because if the nozzle is efficiently designed at the correct angle, and trust me, these Japanese companies have spent years and millions of dollars doing the research to put it at an exact angle, I think it's quite efficient. The other difficulty with these toilets is they do need electricity. So if you're trying to reduce your carbon footprint, then maybe they're not for you.
Certainly, that's the last thing you're going to worry about if you have one of these toilets, is whether you have enough electricity for it.
The challenge for our Reinvent the Toilet inventors then is to come up with a toilet where even Rose would replace her Toto with one of our reinvented toilets. And frankly, all our reinvented toilets do use water to clean people, but that takes maybe half a liter or a liter. What we're against is the larger amount of water to transport our waste. And while we really talk about the toilet only now, we are, of course, thinking of the whole system. It's not so much the toilet that is unaffordable. It's the sewers and the wastewater treatment plants that are unaffordable. There are some 2 billion, if you like to call them, toilets out there. They're really latrines and septic tanks that are not connected to anything. And indeed, part of our work is not only to reinvent the toilet, but to link services to those latrines and septic tanks so that they can be safely emptied. Because today, those toilets are often emptied by hand, by bucket, and then that waste is dumped around the corner in the alley where kids play. So beyond the actual toilet that we sit on, it's really the whole system of sanitation services that interests us. And a lot of the money that we give out, and we are, by the way, and I can tell you that as a news item, we are announcing a whole new set of grants tomorrow on our blog, some $48 million worth of new grants. But a lot of that is not for reinventing the toilets as the user interface. It's also for systems that are safe and affordable for people to empty their latrines and to generate energy and nutrients from that waste.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll be watching for that announcement tomorrow. Frank Riesberman is the Director of Water Sanitation and Hygiene at the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation in Seattle. And they have the Reinvent the Toilet Challenge. And they've got to get eight people in the running, eight organizations running to a – is there a prize for that, or just you've already given out the money in challenges?
No, part of the challenge is they'll come and present their prototypes next year, and then the winners will get more money for the best toilet.
Great. Rose George is author of The Big Necessity, The Unmentionable World of Human Waste and Why It Matters, a very good reading book, and you know where you might want to read that book. Jim McHale is Vice President of Engineering at American Standard Brands in Piscataway, New Jersey. Thank you, Jim, for taking time to be with us today.
My pleasure.
Have all a great weekend. We're going to take a break and we'll be right back. Stay with us. Science is now sexy. Science has become the theme of TV shows and Broadway plays, film and artwork. And we think it's a real trend, and we've created a whole science and arts section right on our website, entertaining interviews with artists and actors, scientists and celebrities. It's the only one of its kind, and I invite you to check it out at sciencefriday.com/arts. This is Science Friday. I'm Ira Flatow. For the rest of the hour, a look at the state of embryonic stem cell research. Earlier this week, the Geron Corporation announced it was abandoning its research into using embryonic stem cells to treat spinal cord injury. Geron was the first company to get the green light from the FDA to conduct clinical trials using embryonic stem cells. That was way back in 2009. And now, citing, quote, capital scarcity and uncertain economic conditions, the company is looking to sell off that part of its business and focus on other work. Joining me now to talk about the announcement, what it means for other research using embryonic stem cells, is Leonard Zahn. He is an investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute and also director of the stem cell program at Children's Hospital Boston and professor of pediatrics at Harvard Med School. Welcome to Science Friday. Welcome back.
Well, thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure to be here.
Is this a real blow to stem cell, to embryonic stem cell research?
Well, we're certainly saddened by the decision to stop the trial in its midst, and it is upsetting that something would get this far along and have an issue. I think there's a lot going on in the field, and we still are very excited about the promise of stem cell research. But I think as this illustrates, funding that research and looking for the ultimate therapies is going to take some time.
It's sort of a purely business decision then.
From my understanding, that's what happened here. So the company, Geron, had two paths. One was an oncology drug that seemed rather promising, was in phase two trial, and the other was to continue its stem cell research. It was clear that they had put a lot of money into stem cell research, and so they thought that would be a good path, but having to choose one or the other, they then chose the oncology drug path. Now, we don't know everything about those decisions, and obviously there were some patients who were treated, so we don't know if all the decision was made as a business decision, but that's what I've been told informally.
So, as you say, there were four patients who were under treatment, and they had hoped to treat 10 patients?
That's right. That's right. This is a very interesting trial. The idea was that there are embryonic stem cells which can make all the cells of your body. And these cells could be turned into a supportive cells for neurons, for the brain cells and also for the spinal cord cells. And so the idea was once these cells were made, these supportive cells, they could be introduced into a patient who had a spinal cord injury, and they would start supporting the cells and the repair of the neurons would be better if they were treated with these cell, with this cell product. We have 4 patients who are treated, and I guess they wanted to treat 10, and we'll have to follow those patients and see how they do.
1-800-989-8255 is our number if you'd like to talk about this. You can also tweet us at SciFry. These were early stage trials, right? Just phase one.
That's right. That's right. So the idea was really a safety trial is if you were to take patients who are obviously devastated from having a spinal cord injury and then put in these supportive cells, we would want to make sure that they wouldn't cause any damage. And at least from the texts that we've had and other messages, it seems that that there wasn't any major problem in terms of safety with the 4 patients who were treated. A safety trial is only done for safety purposes. It's not to necessarily evaluate efficacy, how well it works. So I think we need to still see how the patients do. But again, it was to find out, is the drug or the cells safe if you put them into a patient who's had a spinal cord injury?
By this company pulling out of actual testing of embryonic stem cell treatments, doesn't that cut drastically the number of companies left who are actually making those tests?
Yes, it's a very small list of companies. So actually, there's only one other company that's doing embryonic stem cell research, and that's a company called ACT. And they are trying to turn these embryonic stem cells into a cell that's in the eye. It's called a retinal pigment epithelial cell. But there are patients who have a genetic disease where those cells are defective, and they end up becoming blind. And the also more common disease, macular degeneration, also affects that cell population. So that company hopes to use the embryonic stem cells to inject them into the eye and try to rescue the blindness or prevent the blindness that occurs in this particular genetic disease called Stargardt's disease. So short of that, there aren't other companies who are using embryonic stem cells, but there's a growing number of companies that are switching and trying to use reprogrammed skin cells. When we talked last time a few years ago, we discussed how this new technology could take a skin cell and reprogram it to think it's an embryonic stem cell. And these cells, in many ways, have great abilities to be matched for the patient, let's say, for their immune system. So there's a number of companies now who are trying to make those cells functional and then trying to use them to do transplantation to fix a disease. Those cells also end up being very interesting because you can make disease-specific cells. So you can take a disease and actually study it in a dish, a disease in a dish, and then try to find drugs that would be used to treat those diseases. And this is something that we're even seeing pharmaceutical companies get involved in using stem cell technology.
What about the shortage now? As Geron backs out, don't they have a whole population of cells to use? And what's going to happen to that cell line or those cell lines that they have?
Absolutely. It's a very interesting discussion. We have to know that Geron has the largest number of cell lines that we know of for embryonic stem cells, and we would like to know what's going to happen to those stem cell lines. Obviously, it's a business, and they probably will want in their partnering opportunities to sell it to another business, but it does create an issue for the stem cell field, what will happen to those lines, and how will they be used in the future.
And would somebody take over continuing those lines, or did they just throw them out?
Well, that would be a very significant shame. I think that those lines are incredibly valuable, and we'd like to see them used for both biology as well as for medicine. And so hopefully they'll be placed in the care of a good company, and they'll use them. And, I think what's interesting now when we look at this clinical trial is how will the results of the clinical trial actually get reported? You have 4 patients treated, and, will they be followed? valid? Will they be reported in the scientific literature? Those are also important things for the company to decide. And if they're trying to partner that opportunity, how will their new partner or new or when they sell the business, how will that company actually deal with that information? So both the lines as well as the dealing with the clinical trial that obviously these patients are already transplanted and will be followed, that's going to require some insight from the new company.
And if I recall, there was a huge regulatory hurdle for the company to overcome, all kinds of paperwork and documentation.
That's right.
And it's expenses that way.
Absolutely. There was an amazing amount of paperwork that went into this. As you might expect, when a totally new therapy comes about, the FDA is going to be involved in a very responsible way, asked for a number of experiments to be done, preclinical experiments that would allow them to ultimately do the trial. This took many, many years and many millions of dollars. So in a significant way, Geron has played an important role by forging this pathway of regulatory hurdles. So I think for future companies that come in, the FDA will know how to deal with this to some degree, and I think that new therapies won't have to do it as much work as has been done for Geron.
All right, let's go to the phones, 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Jerry in Cookeville, New Jersey. Hi, Jerry.
Oh, that's Cookeville, Tennessee.
I'm sorry. Cookeville.
That's okay.
That's close by, right?
Very interesting conversation with the gentleman we're just talking about with the human stem cells and all the promise that's really showing. And as far as embryonic stem cells go, I really don't think that it's really done a whole lot, you know, considering all the different treatments they use human stem cells. I mean, before long, that'll be like wanting to keep building wagons when the car is the wave of the future.
Well, I think it's interesting that the embryonic stem cell field really started in 1998 when the first human embryonic stem cells were derived. And you have a need to study those cells for many years before they can become interesting for biology, but also interesting as new therapies. I often discuss, if you look at the history of organ transplant, for instance, bone marrow transplantation, a procedure that's done every day, even here at Children's Hospital, we do hundreds every year. What happens is that in 1961, there was the discovery of the stem cell, and it didn't become a standard of therapy until about the late 1970s. So there's a large gap between the initial discoveries and then ultimately being successful. I do think that what this illustrates from Geron is it took a long time for the company to actually get this therapy into a patient. And that was very costly to deal with all the regulatory hurdles. And so that timeline is just not appetizing for venture capital companies as well as for large pharma. And so the timeline is long, and I think that makes people think, as the caller just said, that it's taking a long time before embryonic stem cells could be therapeutically useful.
Isn't that the weakness of the system, of allowing pharma to do this kind of research instead of having it, let's say, federally funded at NIH or someplace to develop this therapy? Because if they don't do it, if they drop it, it's not going to be developed.
Well, as you know, the entire field of organ transplantation was done completely academically initially. And then once it was clear that it was successful, and I would argue as soon as there's a success for embryonic stem cells or these new reprogrammed skin stem cells, then there'll be an entire industry around being able to make it better. I do think we were held up tremendously by NIH funding, which was not available in the 1990s through a presidential policy. But then over time, that's been loosened up, and there is more money for embryonic stem cell research and also for these skin reprogrammed cells that the NIH is investing in that particular area. So hopefully this will continue and that we'll see over time and, you know, over coming years that that this will be interesting therapeutically.
And where do we let's talk about these stem cells, not the embryonic ones, but the other kinds that people can actually use their own cells and reprogram them. Is there any one disease to you, looking surveying the field, that seems most promising at this point?
Well, I mean, at Children's Hospital, we're trying to use these to turn those cells into blood stem cells, and mm-hmm. being able to use those for patients who don't have a donor for marrow transplantation. I think that there's a lot of research going on in these skin cells. They're called iPS cells. And these skin cells, again, can be made from patients who have a particular disease. So we are making hundreds of lines of different genetic diseases. We just made lines from a very rare blood disease. There's only 100 patients in the world who have that particular disease so that we can study it and understand it. We make it from very common diseases, diabetes and Parkinson's disease also. So pretty much stem cell research could help the many diseases, but they're going to require significant investigation to study each of those diseases and their organs that are affected.
I'm Ira Flatow. This is Science Friday from NPR. Talking with Leonard Zahn, investigator at the Howard Hughes Medical Institute. Our number 1-800-989-8255. Let's go to Richard in Fen Grove, California. Hi.
Hi, Ira. Just love the show. And Dr. Zahn, I wondered if you were aware, I'm sure you are, the story which I only heard about on NPR in the last couple of days, and you'll forgive me, I've forgotten. I don't even think it was in the United States, and probably not because of the unfortunate backward policies that have caused some delay in our research. But the very young, actually baby, I guess it was in the first 5 days, was born and either obtained or born with a virus which destroyed the young person's liver. They had done some clearance work before and research before and had approval to go ahead, and this was the first case, apparently, that it was appropriate, injecting a liver stem cell into the young person, injecting or placing, I don't know how it was, mm-hmm. With a coating from an algae, which allowed the membrane of the algae to provide protective coating against the virus, but permeable still, so that it could actually take over and support the liver function until the young person's liver was healthy enough to restore him to normal health. And I believe he's several months old. Are you aware of this, sir?
Well, I don't know that particular case. I've heard a little bit about it, but not that much about it. It does illustrate how you can use a variety of cells and do transplantation and really affect things, affect organ function. And so we're just at the beginning of seeing how cell therapy can actually work. And so we see a number of studies to try to fix different heart disease and also, as you're illustrating, liver disease. I think that it's important that the people who are listening realize that some of these therapies are rational and have a scientific basis and should be done. And I believe what you're talking about was done in the correct in a reputable institution. I also just want to say that we are very concerned about stem cell tourism. So you do need to worry about some company, let's say, that is telling you they'll fix any type of disease through a particular cell population. And very frequently we find that that group of companies is trying to make money rather than actually trying to help people. Having said that, I don't know this particular instance, so it sounds very fascinating.
But what you're saying is that as soon as some company has a breakthrough in this and creates a real product, everybody else will want to join in on the bandwagon and starts investing more money in research in it.
I think that's true. I mean, we go back to, if you think about IVF, and at a certain point in time, there was a large debate about whether this was ethical as well as whether it should be done at all. And then as soon as there was a baby, I think that entire debate went away. Mm-hmm. I think if you look at organ transplants in the early, in the 60s and 70s, there were a number of patients who did extremely poorly from organ transplants, and a number of the doctors were heavily criticized by trying to do these types of procedures as, it would never work. But then as soon as there was a success, the entire field became much more invigorated, and we were able to see how it could become an industry as well as it could become a standard of therapy.
Dr. Zahn, thank you for taking time to be with us today.
Well, thank you, Ira. It's a pleasure.
Happy holidays to you. Leonard Zahn is a professor of pediatrics at Harvard Med School and also director of the stem cell program at Children's Hospital in Boston. Our program's senior producer is Annette Heiss. Charles Berquist is our director. Flora Lichtman is our multimedia editor. Our producers are Christopher Intagliata and Alessio Bayak. Sam Flato is our production assistant. Our intern is Francie Deep. Neil Rausch is our technical director and at the controls here in New York. I'm Ira Flato. Thanks for listening.